You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Passover celebration began last night, and Easter is this coming Sunday. If you're hosting family or friends for the holidays, meals are often stressful, and because expectations can be high, many people will stick to tried and true recipes. But there's a lot of variety and creativity that you can weave into your Passover and Easter meals, especially now that the weather has finally warmed up and spring produce is once again available. As always, I'm very pleased that Melissa Clark can join us now. She is a James Beard Award-winning food columnist at the New York Times, the author of many cookbooks, the most recent of which is Dinner, Changing the Game. It's published by Penguin Random House. And I'm very pleased to welcome Melissa back to our show.
Hi. So great to be here.
And as always, when you're here, we invite our listeners to join the conversation. If you want to talk about the holidays or just cooking in general, give us a call, 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at wmyc.org/Lopate or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Melissa, did you have a Seder last night?
We did have a Seder last night, and it was the first time I actually led the Seder, which was a different experience for me. You know, I've always been a participant, but it was my show. So, you know, being that it was my show, I tried to get to the food a little faster.
You posted a very nice picture on Instagram of your Seder wines. What kind of wine would you have on the table?
You know, normally you would have kosher for Passover wines, actually, and we always have in the past. But this year we were feeling a little special, so my dad went into the cellar and he picked out some non-kosher for Passover, but some old Bordeaux wines that we enjoyed. It was an interesting year. Yeah, so we had red wines. But, you know, kosher for Passover wines have been getting much better over the years. So I think, you know, you have a lot more choice, and over the years we've enjoyed a lot of them.
But I've always wondered about whether you can really do wine pairings because the food ranges so much. There's fish and there's meat.
You know, that it's true because
and
usually
there people only eat vegetables.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, traditionally you have the four, you know, you have to have the four glasses of wine for Passover. And traditionally you have your Passover wine, your Manischewitz, but we have definitely been changing that up. And then this year we had, you know, we were pulling out wines, we were changing things, and we had a Sancerre with our our gefilte fish course, except that instead of gefilte fish I made a special thing with tuna, but it was, you know, with horseradish, and it encapsulated the spirit of the gefilte fish. But it was nice to have
different
color wines.
Well, the Haggadah doesn't demand gefilte fish.
And it doesn't demand that all the wine needs to be Concord grape, Manischewitz, Passover wine. So you can mix it up if you are, you know, depending on your family and how kosher you want to be. So for us, it was fine. We did two glasses of white and two glasses of red.
So by doing tuna, you already are revealing that you didn't stick to the totally traditional.
We didn't stick. We were pretty traditional, but not entirely. We had the matzo ball soup. My mother makes a great matzo ball soup, so we had that. You know, there are different philosophies in different families about the matzo balls. I don't know how you guys do. Do you like the hard little ones? Or the
My
big,
mother made
ones?
Them hard, but last night we had the soft, fluffy kind.
Yeah, those are good, too.
We love my mother's cannonballs, we used to call them. But the fluffy ones could be great, too.
Yeah, my grandmother always made the little hard ones, and my mother makes them somewhere in the middle. You know, not too fluffy, but not too hard. Somewhere right in the middle.
There's also the whole matter of timing, because the meal doesn't begin until the first part of the Haggadah is read through, and you can't really predict how long that's going to take. So, what does that mean for somebody who's cooking?
You know, last night I had done a lot of the cooking, and I think most Seder foods are things you make in advance anyway. The only thing that I did last minute was to heat up things and to toss a big salad. And you don't even necessarily need a salad because you have so many, you know, you have all the herbs and you have the, you know, the parsley and the lettuce that you pass around. So
and
even
the nuts and the wine and the apples.
Exactly. And you have your haroset, so you have your apples. So you don't even strictly need a salad, although we like a salad. And it's perfectly kosher for Passover to have a salad.
Last year, you published a recipe at the Times with the headline, "For Juicy Beef for Your Seder Table, Look Beyond Brisket." You had a simmered beef recipe?
Yes. You know, I didn't do brisket this year. I think I might be taking a brisket hiatus. I don't know. Did you have brisket last night?
Yeah.
You did have. I think everybody, most people have brisket. I like brisket, but I don't love brisket the way I love, say, last night we did short ribs. And you know what? Short ribs are so tender and so good. Even my little niece and nephew, who traditionally don't like any kind of, you know, soft cooked meat, they were loving this because it was just so succulent.
Well, the Haggadah talks about lamb, and we'll get to lamb in a little bit, because lamb applies both to some Jewish traditions and also to the Easter tradition. But another thing that you don't see on tables a lot around the year is horseradish, yet I always appreciate it on a Passover Seder. Do you make your own?
I do. I do. So I went to the farmer's market, and they had the biggest, you know, biggest horseradish roots ever. So I got one root, and it was enough for, I could cut it up, and we had some for the Seder plate, because you need to have some horseradish on the Seder plate. And then the rest I ground in the food processor. And it just has such an amazing, intense flavor. You know, it clears your sinuses. It just makes you tingle. It feels really good. And we just don't do it except on Passover. So it's one of those special Passover foods that I wish we did more often.
Now, you said you don't make your own gefilte fish. Is it because it's too difficult?
No, it was...
It does take a lot of time.
You can do it in the food processor. I know that that's not exactly the way you're supposed to do it, you know, and you do get a finer grind. If you chop it by hand, you get the irregular pieces, which makes it very fluffy. I would love to know how many of your listeners out there have made their own gefilte fish, and if they do it every year, and do they use the food processor? When I do it, I do use the food processor. You can make gefilte fish into, you know, you can poach it in its traditional shape, are the balls. But I have been doing it in a loaf pan, more like a tureen, and then you can slice it. You can serve these nice, neat slices.
What about brisket? Do you have a favorite brisket recipe?
So when I do brisket, I like to do what's called the second cut of brisket. You know, most people buy the brisket, it's the first cut. And the first cut is very lean, and I find it harder to keep it moist and to get it really juicy. I find that it's just very quick to dry out. You have to catch it at that right moment. But the second cut has, now that's where all the fat is, and the fat is what gives you flavor. And, you know, it's not necessarily a lot fattier to eat because the fat cooks out, you know, it renders and it just makes the meat very soft. And then if you make it a day before or 2 days before, which I highly recommend for any kind of braise, then you just pull the extra fat right off the top. So you're left with very silky meat that's not necessarily, you know, fatty.
I'm speaking with Melissa Clark, the James Beard Award-winning food columnist of the New York Times. You can find her column every Wednesday in the food section of the Times. And, of course, she has a new cookbook just recently published called Dinner Changing the Game. There's always a vegetarian.
There's always a vegetarian, yes.
There was one last night.
There were two. and that's fine, too. You know, you can do lots of I mean, there's no reason not to have lots of vegetables at your Seder. It's funny, though, because, you know, this time of year, we don't have a lot of, you know, fresh vegetables. We certainly don't have local asparagus yet. I know that we, in the past, have always served asparagus anyway. Just, it's not local, but it's a harbinger of spring, and it's something that people really look forward to. This year, I stuck to more local things. I did some squash, because I could get it, and you know, broccoli, you know, things like that. And there's no reason not to have lots of that. So we had lots of different vegetables.
You also have a recipe in the Times for matzah brei.
Oh, yeah. I have a new matzah brei. I love matzah brei. Where are you with matzah brei? Yes or no? Not so
that
much?
Was the only thing my father ever cooked.
Oh, okay.
Yes, every year he would make matzah brei and be very proud of the fact that he finally had cooked something. But it was delicious. I like it. It has a little bit of a crunch to it.
Me too. I like it when it gets like crispy on the edges, right? Mm-hmm. Some people like super soft matzah brei. That's like more like a scramble.
For people who don't know, what is matzah brei?
Okay, so matzah brei is a traditional Passover breakfast, or you can eat it for dinner. And you take your matzah and you cook it with eggs. So basically you're making like scrambled eggs and matzah. But there are these different ways to interpret it. Some people like their matzah brei more like a pancake, so that you cook it until it's hot. It's like a frittata almost, except it has matzah
inside. Do you soak
inside.
The matzah first?
Well, there's different thoughts on that. I like to soak the matzah just very briefly because I still want some texture. Some people will soak it in hot water until it's completely soft, and then you get a much softer scramble. I like a little texture. I also like a crispness. And what's interesting is, so the recipe I wrote for the Times, what I've been doing lately is I briefly soak the matzah, then I take my butter, and I heat my butter until it actually gets to be brown butter, and I cook the matzah in the brown butter, and I get it super crisp. Then I add my eggs. So you really have a contrast between soft eggs, crispy matzah that has this buttery flavor, and it's just delicious.
And this is fine for anybody, whether they are Jewish or not. But what about the matzah? Because for most of my life, matzah came in a box, and it was square, and now I see a lot of what's called shmura matzah around, artisanal matzah. Do you discern a big difference in the taste?
Yeah, I find the shmura matzah to have a lot more character, but it's harder to get. It's harder to use in a matzah brei because it really is. It's crunchier.
Would you ever imagine making your own matzah? It's unleavened bread.
You know, I don't know if I'm. I think that I have made my own matzah, but I don't think it's kosher for Passover because I think that in order for matzah to be kosher for Passover, you have to have a rabbi watching over the whole 18-minute, you know, it's an 18-minute process. You've got to be start to finish. So you start mixing the dough, and then it has to be completely baked within 18 minutes, and you need a rabbi to make sure that you actually did do that. So
if you have one in the family,
if you happen to have a rabbi in the family, and I think your kitchen would need to be more kosher for Passover than my kitchen currently is. Let's just leave it at that.
We have invited calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. And let's go to John from Paramus, New Jersey. You're on the air.
Yes, it's always a pleasure to hear you and to read you, Melissa. So I barbecue a leg of lamb for about 12 or 14 people every year, and I use your recipe to marinate it. But because it's uneven, it's very difficult to cook sometimes. I think last year I made it a little more well done than I'd like to. So what do you think I should cook it for, about 30 minutes? And how much does it cook after you take it off the grill?
Now, you're talking about a butterfly leg of lamb?
Yeah, I'm sorry, a butterfly, yeah.
Okay,
it's
right.
It's a big piece, yeah.
Exactly, and the problem, I think you're exactly right. The problem with a butterfly leg of lamb is that it is very uneven. Now, in our family, that works because there's some people who like the meat on the rare side and some people who like it more well done. So, you know, what's nice about this uneven cut is that you get some part, the thinner parts get more cooked and then the thicker parts are a little more rare. So that works for us. However, if it doesn't work for your family, I think you have two options. If you want the meat to cook evenly, what you could do is, you know, you take the butterfly leg of lamb and you roll it up and you kind of create like you almost like a roulade, like you make a roll and then it's even all the way through. I think that's a little fussy personally. So another thing is cook the meat. You like it? How do you like it? Pink or?
Well, my family's the same way. Some people like it well done. My mother-in-law, who's 91, likes it rare. You know, she would. She says, it's got to be rare, but it's got to be rare, you know, that type of thing. And my wife likes it well done. There's all different people there. It's all different varieties.
So you're good. So, okay, I think the thing to do then is take it off when it's on the rare side. Cut off the thicker parts that are nice and rare, and then put the rest back on the grill, and they'll get a little crispy, a little more well done. You just got to watch it.
Thanks for calling. And now we go to Camille from Manhattan. Hi, Camille.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call, and Chag Sameach. I hope that was right.
Perfect.
I'm completely non-secular. I'm secular. But I think that I might have discovered the perfect wine to bridge the divide between Easter and Passover. And while I've been observing Lent, I've been having a lot of Ethiopian food. So this has led me to think about wine, the honey wine, the Tej, and it seems biblical. And I know that Moses married Zipporah, who was Ethiopian, and we have the Coptic Christians as well. So it may be a little sweet for dinner. Maybe it's better for dessert. But I'm just crazy about this honey wine. And that's the first thing. So it's not a question, it's a comment. And my question is, I was wondering if you knew the derivation of this shashuka, which I'm also in love. It's my favorite new breakfast.
Okay, well, I love I'm so with you on the shakshuka, and a shakshuka is a North African, Israeli, Middle Eastern dish. There are a lot of versions of it in all of those parts of the world. You know, I think most of the versions we have are Israeli, but it spans a much bigger area. And what it is it's vegetables, usually peppers and tomatoes and onions that are cooked until they become a sauce. And then you take eggs and you crack the eggs right in this hot simmering sauce, cover the pan, and then you get these soft, runny yolked eggs all over this delicious vegetable, oniony oniony matter, and it's so good. It is actually perfectly kosher for Passover, and I think that it's one of those that we have a recipe. I have a recipe that I add a little feta cheese to. You can find it on the New York Times website, and but it's just a great dish. So I think that's a great reminder. You don't have to have matzah brei. You can also have shakshuka. It is a very great Passover. Good for dinner, good for breakfast. And the honey wine is interesting. You couldn't really have that, I don't think. In fact, listeners, please tell me what you all think. But I don't think you could do it for Passover during the Seder because you need vine. You need actual fruit. Mm. You need juice from the grapes. You need grape juice. It has to be a product of
fruit
grapes.
Fruit of the vine.
Right. Although my 6-year-old nephew said that it doesn't actually mean fruit of the vine. It means something from grapes specifically. He was very specific with me. And again, listeners, let me know what you know. But so I don't think that would work for the Seder itself, but it's an interesting idea.
And you can call us at 212-433-9692 if you have any more knowledge about these wines or whatever else, and you want to talk to Melissa. You can also find her recipes not just in her New York Times on the Times website, but also in her most recent book, which is called Dinner Changing the Game. It's published by Penguin Random House. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Melissa Clark, the James Beard Award-winning food columnist for the New York Times, author of many cookbooks. The most recent, you just visited us recently to talk about it, Dinner, Changing the Game. It's published by Penguin Random House. We're going to take more calls, but we've only been talking about Passover, and Easter is... has its own food traditions, although there is one dish in dinner that seems to me would go with on both tables, and that is the Georgian lamb kebabs.
I know this is a lamb dish that is not traditional for Easter. It is not traditional for Passover, but it would work beautifully for either one. And you know, it's true. You know, we were talking earlier about how lamb is such a. It's a talk about harbingers of spring. I mean, this is a meat that is traditionally eaten in spring. It's very traditional for Easter.
And I think Passover, Pesach, the Hebrew word, comes from the word paschal.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a lot, but yet we don't seem to eat lamb on Passover. Not that we certainly could eat lamb on Passover.
I think in the Sephardic tradition, it's more likely.
Yeah, probably. Well, I mean, in the Sephardic tradition, you eat very different foods in general.
And that would be, Georgians would be in the Sephardic tradition. We're talking about Georgia, the country, not Georgia, the southern state. It's also a country that's producing a growing number of wines. Can you find any Georgian wines in the local wine shop?
You can. Oh, my gosh. You can, actually. And a friend of mine, Alice Firing, wrote a book all about Georgian wines. The Georgian wine tradition is fascinating. And it is something, it's very ancient, but it's also contemporary as well. It's changed, but yet it's still really, it's very traditional, its winemaking techniques. And you can find them, I'm trying to think of what shops, gosh, I wish Alice were here. But, you know, if you go, Alice has a newsletter called The Firing Line, and she has a lot about Georgian wines. For anyone who's interested, it's something to discover.
We have posted your recipe for Georgian lamb kebabs on our show page at WMIC.org, and I would be curious to know what kinds of Georgian wines would go with it. What grapes are the Georgians making their wines from? Because I think winemaking actually begins in that part of Asia and then moves to Europe with the Greeks.
Yes, exactly. That's the tradition, is that that winemaking started in Georgia. So, in fact, maybe we can even get the link to some more information about Georgian wines. We can put that on your website. I'm sure we can do that.
Let's take some more calls. Lior from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys?
We're well.
Great.
You want to talk about gefilte fish?
Yeah, you mentioned the gefilte fish and using a food processor, and it does make it a much finer consistency, but it also lends itself to not being as well seasoned. I find that doing it through a meat grinder attachment on a KitchenAid mixer works out the best.
That's a good idea. Actually, I've never tried that. You know, I've chopped it by hand, and I've done it in the food processor, but the meat grinder, aha.
Yeah, that really gives you nice texture, good flavor, does spread it out really well. And then even if you do it chorizo style, it works out great as well.
That's great. Okay, thank you. Thank you for that.
You're
yes,
welcome.
I'm going to try that in the terrine, so I don't have to make the individual canals, but yet I'll have the coarser texture. And the coarser texture really is nicer. It's airier.
Then
thank you.
Julie Miller writes on our show page, my grandmother actually used to buy live carp, whitefish, and yellow pike and keep them in the bathtub until it was time to make her fish. She says, I get mine ground from the fish store, but follow my mother's recipe to the T.
Oh, you can buy ground fish? You can buy it ground? Really? At the fishmonger? You can do that? Wow. It never occurred to me to ask.
And now we go to L'Amour in Astoria. Is that what your name really is, L'Amour?
Yes, that's my first name, L'Amour.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. And is your last name Dorothy?
No, it's what my mother loves. She loved the name Dorothy L'Amour, so she named me L'Amour.
Ah.
But it isn't dark. It isn't.
That's a great name to have.
Thank you so much. Well, I have a great recipe for matzo brie. And because I cook for a crowd, the quantities are large, but you can scale it back. But you'll get the idea when I tell you the recipe. I take 4 eggs, 4 yolks, 1/4 cream. I mix that up, put a little salt and pepper in it, and I soak the matzo brie crushed up in that. I have sautéed wild mushrooms on the side, some fresh scallions, chopped thyme. I add to the matzo brie soaking, and then I take a couple of no-stick pans, the small omelet-sized ones, like 8-inch, no uh-huh. larger. And then I put I put olive oil in it, a generous amount, and then I sear. I put in the bottom portion of the matzo brie that has soaked in the custard. And then I put a layer of wild mushrooms, and then I put another layer of the matzo brie on top, and then flip it over. So it's nice and brown on both sides. Mm. And then once it's browned on both sides, you got to be really...
It sounds like really like a...
Flip it over.
Like a mushroom dish.
It's delicious.
And then you bake it?
And then what I do is I finish it in the oven on a sheet pan that's on a cooling rack.
Wow.
Bake it in the oven... And it's custardy and rich and delicious.
Oh, my God. That
so,
sounds amazing
so
and completely.
Wonderful.
Was that your recipe or so you found it's, that?
Oh, no, absolutely not. I'm really a chef by trade of many years. I don't work as a chef anymore, but I make, yes, that's my recipe.
That is a great idea. I might steal that. And I know how to give you credit because your name, L'Amour, is so beautiful. I will remember forever. Thank you. That is a great idea. The custard is interesting, you know. You don't hear that.
It comes out. So, light, and it's just yummy, absolutely yummy. And you put whatever herbs you like. I happen to like thyme with mushrooms and scallion or whatever. But, definitely, go for it.
Thanks so much for calling and sharing that, L'Amour.
You're very welcome, and have a happy Passover.
You
Bye-bye.
Too.
Another recipe that we have taken from your recent book that we have posted that people might find interesting to make, this is from... Melissa Clark's book, Dinner, is sugar snap pea salad with watermelon radishes, mint, and manchego.
Yeah, so peas, I mean, again, it's like we don't have them locally yet, but they're about to come into the market. You know, I think maybe one more month, perhaps, and they just... They make you think of spring. And so, you know, I do think for holiday, you know, as much as I like to be local, for holiday, if you can get good peas, sugar snap peas, and I love them raw. So I like to make a salad where I thinly slice the sugar snap peas and I have them raw. And then, of course, you can still get watermelon radishes and a little bit of cheese.
Can I use frozen peas?
Not for this one. No, you got to use, because they're raw. If you were blanching them, you totally could. But because they're raw, you need like that crisp, juicy texture. So either, you know, try to find some good ones or wait, you know, hang on to that recipe for a little bit. It's just, it's so crunchy and so juicy. It's just such a nice, especially if you're serving it with a rich meat like lamb, it just works really well together. So moving on to Easter, I would think that is such a pretty dish for an Easter table because the watermelon radishes, when you slice them, are pink. So you've got the pink and the green. What could be prettier?
I'm speaking with Melissa Clark, who is the James Beard Award-winning food columnist of the New York Times. You'll find her column every Wednesday, which means tomorrow.
Tomorrow, yes.
What are you featuring tomorrow?
Okay, so tomorrow we're going off topic. A nod to Passover. Last week I did a roasted carrot salad, which is really nice this time of year with arugula. And then tomorrow's column is more geared toward Easter. So, celebrating Easter is something new for me. I did not do this growing up, but I do it now with my husband and my daughter. And I imagine, in my mind, you should have a big fluffy cake for Easter, right? Something with lots of eggs, because eggs are another traditional springtime ingredient. And it's interesting why. I never knew this, but as I was researching, I was like, why are eggs? You know, eggs, you don't think of eggs as being seasonal, but in fact, they are seasonal because chickens before electricity, when there was a lot less light and it was cold, they didn't lay all year long as prolifically as they do in the spring. So when your chickens started to lay a lot, that meant spring was coming and you could use them in your desserts.
And let's talk more about eggs after I reveal that. You're listening to the Leonard Lopate Show on WMIC, WMIC.org. I am Leonard Lopate. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. So what about eggs? Well, first of all, eggs are part of both the Passover and the Easter celebrations. And something simple like hard-boiled egg, you find all sorts of different suggestions on how to make them.
Oh, people have inflexible ideas of what they do with their don't you find that people, you know, they do their hard-boiled eggs one way? I like to play around with different
techniques.
I thought
you just boil the water, stick the egg in, maybe put a little salt in the water.
Yeah, put salt in the water or do you not? Do you put the egg straight from the fridge or do you let it come to room temperature? Do you put it in the boiling water or do you put it in the cold water and bring it to a boil? There are so many variations.
What do you think?
Okay, so lately I've been using my electric pressure cooker. I know, I can't. What can I tell you? That's been because it makes the eggs easy. I find it makes eggs easier to peel, especially if you have very fresh eggs. You know, eggs are harder to peel if they're super fresh.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem. Sometimes you're peeling them and you leave all sorts of dents in the egg.
And not very pretty for your Seder plate or for your Easter dinner. But yes, so eggs are something that I think we should eat more of them all year long, but especially right now.
And in Passover, they're usually served with salt water.
Yes, exactly. Or
I don't know why they're not served that way the rest of the year. It's delicious.
It's good, right?
Let's go to Barbara. Barbara from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi. I had a question. Well, I love your show, and I love reading about Melissa. And I have a recipe that it says it wants 1 8-pound bone and leg of lamb, shank attached, Frenched. Now, I'm going to probably buy like a leg of lamb that's just like the leg of lamb.
Yeah.
And so what do I do to make it like this?
You're good. I mean, that's someone who's giving you too much information in the recipe.
Oh.
So don't worry about it. You know, you can buy a whole leg of lamb or you could buy a half leg of lamb.
Mm-hmm.
If you just ask for approximately 8-pound piece of bone-in leg of lamb, you're going to get the recipe is going to work fine. So, you know, don't worry too much about the Frenching. The Frenching is when they clean the bone for you, so it makes a prettier presentation and it's kind of sticking out. You know, have you seen
She could clean the bone herself.
You can't, but you don't need, unless you're going to unless you really want to showcase it, I wouldn't worry about it. That's something more for presentation than for flavor.
Oh, okay.
Okay, good luck.
Oh, good. Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.
Now, you mentioned cake. Of course, Passover,
right.
You have to make a flourless cake.
Yes.
Well, can you make cake with matzah meal?
You can. I never turns out that well, though. I don't love matzah meal cake flour. I prefer, last night I did an almond cake, you know, very traditional Passover almond cake where you separate the eggs and you get, because you can't use leaveners, so you need to beat the egg whites in order to get the cake to rise. The cake that I have in the Times tomorrow is an ambrosia cake. Mm-hmm. It's a big fluffy cake. The Think Easter, it's not kosher for Passover, but it is.
Like a birthday cake?
Almost. Like, you know, like a southern coconut cake with lots of coconut on the outside, except this one has the flavors of ambrosia inside the filling, orange. It has the coconut on the outside, and then it also has, an orange curd. So it's a lovely cake, some strawberries on top, too. Very pretty.
You use coconut oil.
I use coconut oil and coconut butter, or coconut butter. You can use either one, whichever you see, and lots of the sweetened shredded coconut, the kind that you buy in the bag. I love that stuff. Truth be told, I love that stuff.
And then, of course, you can also make the coconut layer cake for Easter. You've supplied that recipe as well.
That is true. So you have lots of fluffy coconut cake Easter recipes. Am I doing it right? I feel like I'm new to the whole Easter thing, so I'm just sort of feeling my way. I've got the chocolate bunnies down, but the dessert, I'm like, is that appropriate? I can do the Passover one, though.
Now, we have gotten a call about Hebrew. Yuval called to say that Geffen means vine.
Okay, good. Thank you.
And corrects me on Pesach. I always thought it was a kind of a pun, Paschal and Passover. But he says Pesach means to skip over or to step over, as the angel of death stepped over the Jewish people when he killed the firstborn of the Egyptians.
Yeah, well, Pharaoh wouldn't let the people go, you know? It's a harsh story. Reading it every year, it's
now,
harsh.
A, A listener tweeted us to ask about whether you have a good sous vide Passover brisket recipe.
Okay. So I don't have sous vide yet. I have not. Do you have a sous vide machine yet?
I do not.
I need to
but
do that.
You could just do it with something in a bag, can't you?
Yeah, you could actually. You could, you know.
The French originally did it in kind of a pig bladder, if I remember correctly.
Anything that'll steal the air out, and you want. I think that's a great idea for. I think it's a great thing to try. So no, the short answer is no. I'm interested. Maybe talk to me next year if I can play with it this year or next year. I like the idea of a brisket recipe in sous vide because I think it would make – if any of your listeners have tried that, let us know. I think it would make it very tender. I think that would eliminate a lot of the problem of, you know, the potentially tough brisket meat.
But the Board of Health actually went after some restaurants that were making sous vide dishes. What was the problem?
Oh, you know, you have to have a special – you actually have to have, I think, a special either certificate or you have to have had a lesson. There's something about sous vide that is not – you can't just do it without being certified to do it. So restaurateurs were doing it, but they didn't have the proper training or the proper licensing.
Now, many people have advised that when you're having a lot of people over for a meal, you should stick to the tried and trues. Do you agree for Passover, for Easter?
I think that if you're a nervous cook – then yes, for sure. If anything to bring your anxiety level down when you're having people over and you're cooking for a large number, yes, do the thing that you know your family loves. I mean, it's a win-win. However, in our family, we do something new every year. Everything we do, you know, so we never do the same gefilte fish recipe. Like, for example, this year I did tuna. We don't even make the same haroset every year. We mix it up a little bit. Some years we're going to put dates in it, and some years we're not going to. My sister made it, and it was delicious. Last night she did almonds instead of walnuts. Mm-hmm. That's just the kind of family we are. So I think, I really do think that, I think it's good to mix things up to the extent of which you're comfortable.
Before you go, Liz from New Jersey called in to say that her go-to shower gift is your dinner book.
Oh.
Combined with a cooking sheet and a roll of aluminum foil.
Oh, she's the best. That's such a good gift. Yes, I'm going to leave everybody with this one thought. Go buy yourself a rimmed baking sheet. You'll be very happy that you did.
Melissa, looking forward to seeing you again real soon.
Happy Passover, happy Easter, Leonard.
Meanwhile, I'll be reading you in the Times tomorrow. And, of course, I have my own copy of Dinner, Changing the Game, published by Penguin Random House.